Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Anoush.
And on this week in a special episode,
we discuss all of the candidates for the Labour leadership election.
In punishing amounts of detail.
We're joined by Alva Ray and Patrick Maguire to discuss, first of all, the Labour leadership contest, which has kicked off in earnest.
Ooh.
So, Patrick, you were at the hustings, or at least
I was
lurking outside them.
Craning my neck to the door. And hearing nothing other than the chuntering of my lobby colleagues, yes. who won? I suppose the question, maybe you weren't going to ask that question, but I'll answer it anyway. Lisa Nandy, who is among the second tier of candidates who might struggle to reach the 21 MP threshold for inclusion on the ballot. Of course, Keir Starmer, at the time of recording, is the only person to have cleared that. He cleared it on day one, which is a sign of just how thirsty the PLP is for someone with a prime ministerial haircut. you know, and the Conservative MP is coming out as saying, you know, Lisa Nandy knocked it out of the park, which is significant because, you know, she needs to wow MPs. You know, people are saying, you know, Clive Lewis had some interesting ideas for a master's seminar on politics, but not necessarily leadership material. Whereas Emily Thornberry, the consensus was she didn't have a great night, which, given that she only has one backer who isn't herself, not great. So that's the live land in terms of the second tier candidates. Obviously, then you have listeners at home can sing the chorus. But Keir Starmer is cleared the MP threshold and is halfway, having got the endorsement of Unison today to reach the next stage. Then Jess Phillips and Rebecca Lombardi are probably both likely to reach 21 MPs. I don't know what you guys think.
Jess is basically the only candidate to the extent that, I mean, one of the many intriguing, to me at least, decisions about that particular campaign is it is a campaign of someone who, if you look at the things they actually believe, if you look at the year in which they were selected, is not on the right of the party, yet they are the candidate who is both running as and has become like the preferred lever of choice for the sort of unrepentant or whatever, you know, the kind of like, you know, look, the members will listen to us tendency, right? They are essentially running to the platform of like, I'm a winner, which is a bold choice when you are not the most well-known candidate.
It's interesting comparing that pitch to Liz Kendall's in 2015, which was very much, it was a change or die pitch.
Yeah.
But, and I don't mean they aren't substantial in a pejorative sense. I mean, in the literal sense of the word substantial. Like, okay, Jess has been, you know, been more willing to critique policy than the rest of them, although Lisa Nandy is the only person to say she would junk a specific policy thus far. Whereas Kendall was very much like root and branch, let's look at what we are and what we're for as a party. Jess's pitch is basically just, I will say it differently. I don't know what you think.
So
I've been working on this piece, sort of collating all of their major op-eds and interviews, which I thought wasn't going to take that long and has actually been quite a long process. But reading them all and rewatching them in quick succession, I think, really drives that point home that, like, that there's like a huge difference in how much substance there is in each of the pitches. I mean, I think that Jess Phillips pitch is really laid bare when you have to sort of reduce a video or an op-ed to a sentence, and you realise that it's really like, I mean, she said, you know, people like education and safety, and, you know, they think it's radical at the moment, but it shouldn't be. Vote for me. And the implied thing is just, you know, I have the force of personality to win this, unlike everyone else, because I have, you know, this personality that has got a lot of media attention, but that's it. And, I mean, maybe personality is quite important. That's sort of, I was second guessing myself and I thought, well, maybe that is kind of enough. Maybe you just do need someone to say it differently. But it's not very substantial. And to the credit of a lot of the other candidates, there's a lot of substance there.
I think the thing is, I think, one, as you say, like Liz did actually have a substantial set of policy. Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I was reading Blair's Forward to the Unfinished Revolution
again.
Yeah. For the first time. I've never picked it up before. But, you know, one of the many interesting bits in his rules for opposition is, you know, because I was reading it because I was reading James Medway's piece on what he thought had gone wrong. And I thought, oh, I've read this somewhere before. I was fairly certain it was somewhere in the Unfinished Revolution. And interestingly, which actually your policy positions do matter, right? Actually, they are how you signal what your values are. When the only things you can do as leader of the opposition, particularly when there is a large majority, is you can run your party differently or better. In this case, this is a slightly weird thing to say, but the only person in the United Kingdom who is well served by Jeremy Corbyn's failure to tackle anti-Semitism in the Labour Party is whoever his successor as Labour leader is, because it's like they've been given this, like, here's a way you can show change, without having to concede, like, literally on anything, but it's a symbol of them running the party differently. And the other way, of course, is announcing policies. And I just think you can run as the I'm a winner candidate. Obviously, Tony Blair did that and Boris Johnson did that. But they both had done things before becoming leader to indicate to support that. Tony Blair had been a hugely effective shadow Home Secretary, as shadow Employment Secretary, had, you know, changed a lot of Labour's policies on the labour market already. He was a national figure, right? He was someone who was known. He had written substantial pieces about the future of the left, including for the New Statesman. So him going, it's time for a winner, and also, we shouldn't forget, as well as going, it's time for a winner, he did also go, I'll renationalise the railways, and what socialism means to me is. And I find it hilarious the number of people in the Labour Party who basically either say we need a Kinnock or a Blair, but don't seem to have noticed just how much tickling of the Labour stomach Blair and Kinnock did in 1983.
That's the striking thing about the David Miliband victory speech that he never delivered, but somehow at a point of, you know, crisis for Ed Miliband found its way into the pages of The Guardian in 2011 or 12. You know, there's a long passage in there where he goes, this is why I am a socialist, right? And if you think now the David Miliband of the collective imagination in Westminster is centrist dad par excellence, like, you know, you do have to, and, you know, that's why he won among the membership. Like, you know, you don't.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, what I find fascinating, right, is just as a critical mass of baby boomers genuinely seem to believe they fought in World War II, a critical mass of third-generation Blairites, and I use that term in its broadest sense because, in my mind, you're not a Blairite if you don't actually support actually existing Blairism, seem to have believed they've won general elections. Like, this whole thing, like, it's time for a winner. It's like, guys, you've literally won nothing. Some of you quite literally weren't in the party during the last time he won something. Yeah, it's kind of this sort of, you know, kind of almost this weird idea that, like, winning is inherited. It's like, no, he won those things, and yeah, won by using, and yeah, in almost everywhere, I would say, yeah, both from an ideological perspective, a technical perspective, in that he was, you know, he owed his position to his political proximity to Tony Blair. You know, David Miliband did fight a Blairite campaign to win the leadership, which is why he came, you know, had he been a bit nicer to two whole MPs, he would have pulled it off. But I think, you know, when people are like, oh, you know, they're two different electorates. Ultimately, if your claim is, I cannot, for 4 months, say things to woo socially liberal, politically energised people, I can't successfully do that for 4 months without chopping my hopes of winning the general election off at the knees. I just think this idea you think you can do 5 years without accidentally blowing yourself up, I mean, that obviously can't be true, right? Like, it's difficult to win a party election, but it is significantly less difficult than any of the other things. But I just think it's a mistake to go to run as the I'm change candidate if you're not a national figure. Most people do not have a clue who Jess Phillips is. You see this in the polls about who the most electable one is, where they pick Keir Starmer. And I'm not saying this in a negative or a positive way about Keir Starmer. It may be that that is correct, and that when voters get to know all of them, they will still believe him to be the most electable one. But what they are actually reacting to is they've heard of him and he has a reassuring chin. Like, but that is why it's an act of lunacy if you are a not Keir Starmer candidate to have the subtext of your message, it's time to win, because you are asking a question to which you are... You may well be the answer.
You're pushing people towards Keir Starmer if you're making up the question of the campaign.
Because you're saying winning is the most important quality of any future leader.
Any member who is convinced by the argument that it's time for a winner, if they look at what all of the actual evidence shows, essentially, right, the one thing the polls can tell you about the electability of the candidates, and I'm going to include all of the candidates, including the ones who have, dropped out already, the only two candidates who were ever considered might be running in this race whose electability you can draw any conclusions on are Keir Starmer and Yvette Coopers, because they are both people who people have heard of. And I find many things astonishing about, like, why people think that the person who shadowed Theresa May, who literally became prime minister at the end of that process, is the answer. But she's actually not that popular, and unlike any of the others, right, she is a known quantity to most voters. I think probably quite a lot of them believe things that Harriet Harman has done, she's done, but, that's neither here nor there.
I sort of feel like the frequency with which we are told by people in Westminster and on Twitter that a leader is someone the Tories will really fear is in inverse proportion to how good they would actually be in the country. I don't know that's just my prejudice against groupthink. He says, grubbing for likes on Twitter with groupthinky statements, but you know what I mean, and Cooper is one of those memes.
I think it is, but I also think it's what you're saying about Keir Starmer having the reassuring chin. There was a Tory pollster who I was speaking to who was saying, oh, the person they'd most fear hands down is Keir Starmer, and when you actually ask about that, it's just, it really is kind of lawyer goggles, I think. And Jess Phillips actually said it herself, though she didn't mention him by name, at an event we had for the New Statesman before Christmas, where she said people see a white man in a suit who's a lawyer or whatever profession and think that's a leader. And they see a woman, trying to do the same thing, and they think maybe one day. And I do, while I think there's a big problem with Jess Phillips' pitch for the leadership in terms of what you were saying, Stephen, I do think that that's true. And I think that the Labour Party have to be really careful with prioritising this sort of mythical competence, which I'm putting in air quotes for listeners because I know you can't see me, and like sacrificing who actually might be the best opponent to Boris Johnson if they become leader, because surely this isn't just about charisma or leadership, because the Labour Party had the same problems that Jeremy Corbyn had before Jeremy Corbyn. So it's really easy and seductive for these candidates to think the only problem, because it was said on the doorstep, was Jeremy Corbyn, and I'm not Jeremy Corbyn, I'm better than him, and so I can fix all these problems and be a winner. But actually, that's just too simplistic, and unfortunately, it's not that easy, if only it was.
It did feel a lot like in the aftermath of the 2015 general election, where it felt like a lot of the candidates were essentially running on a ticket of, wasn't it great how from 2010 to 2015 we didn't have to make decisions, but we were kind of important, because whenever the government got stuck, we got to still go in and like talk about equal marriage, and we were still influential. And now, thanks to Ed Miliband, it's like, well, thanks to Ed Miliband, you've gone from a hung parliament but a defeat to a repudiation, and makes it look like you're probably not going to be back for some time. And Corbyn, of course, has had this weird thing where he managed to basically end up being the Ed Miliband to his own Gordon Brown, in that he inherited a wreck, got the wreck out of the ditch, then drove the wreck back into the ditch, set the wreck on fire. But it does mean that it feels like a lot of the candidates are running in a kind of like, well, that ditch was pretty good, wasn't it? I can get us back to the ditch. And it's like, guys, the ditch was terrible. The ditch was still, the third successive defeat on the second, was still, so only two defeats, but it was still defeat after defeat. I agree that, there is always a problem that if you look for competence, you advantage the candidates who look like the person who has been a candidate already. Mm-hmm. However, and I'm not saying I think it was the only thing that went wrong for Jo Swinson on the campaign trail, I do think there has been a particular failure on the part of people on the right of the Labour Party, who broadly have similar politics to Jo Swinson, to look at what happened to her and go, does that have implications? Yeah, like, this is the thing, it's like, I completely do think that the competent stuff is freighted with all sorts of, kind of ideas about Keir looks like 23 out of the 25 people to have done this job. But if you think about, like, not just in this country, but everywhere where someone who's not the default man wins, they do so by reassuring the default man that they're, you know, they're different but not in a scary way. I mean, like, Sadiq Khan quite literally has a dog that is notionally called Luna, but is actually called, "Don't worry, guys, I'm not one of the scary Muslims." Like, that's why that dog appears in interviews. Like, yeah, like that is its political role in those photos, right? Yeah, like Obama with his whole, like, "I'm going to do a big speech in which I reassure white voters, you know, don't worry, Kwanzaa won't be celebrated in the White House." Or like Helen Clark in New Zealand, like doing this, or Angela Merkel, right? And then you had Jo Swinson, a candidate that running as an explicitly feminist non-default male candidate, and you had people going, "Oh, you know, I just don't like her. Her hands are a bit weird. She seems, you know, she's just kind of a bit shrill." And again, I'm not saying I think the Lib Dem campaign was perfect. I think it did have other deeper problems. But I don't fully understand what that bit of the Labour Party's account of what went wrong for Jo is that they don't think would not also go wrong for Jess Phillips.
Is it, is it just that she has a slightly broader regional accent? That's a genuine, you know, when you hear a Brummie accent, you don't code femininity. Like, I say this with, my dad is from the West Midlands, so, yeah, that's my get-out. But, like, you know, you will hear sort of something different.
She says that herself, actually. She says that sometimes people think she sounds like a bloke and she thinks that it works in her favour. So, yeah, I don't think that's unfair.
No, I do think, Jo had a particularly feminine accent, and also a lot of English voters don't like Scots. I mean, that is like one of the many things that does help the SNP, is the fact that we now have a pretty a growing pool of data that English voters are like, "Guys, you can stay, but you don't get to actually run anything. You know, what do you think this is, 2010? but I mean, so let's actually kind of have a talk about the other candidates, because I think the fact that we've talked about it for so long, which is a central part of their strategy, shows that I think Jess is running a good campaign. I just don't buy that it has a path to 50% of the vote among the membership, and I am slightly dubious that it would work among the country. Let's talk about them in kind of... let's do the second-tier candidates first. Clive Lewis, who may not be long for this earth in a political sense.
He has put a lot of thought into his pitch. And, you know, I think reading through all of his op-eds, I've been impressed by, you know, the depth of thought and consideration. And I think that even if he doesn't make the ballot, a lot of his ideas will be implemented by the party, or should be. And, like, have just been... So, Lords reform, PR, moving power structures away from London, making the party more democratic. This idea that you could, like, be more broadly progressive and, you know, have a better relationship with the Green Party or whatever, and other progressive parties around Europe, rather than sort of, you know, making it more about the left than Europe. I think those are all quite convincing ideas. But unfortunately, he gave a not great interview to Huck magazine in December. So, you know, you would think of Clive Lewis as someone who would, like, have quite a lot of appeal among the sort of Corbynite grassroots, but, like, a lot of those people are, like, big feminists who find... He was talking about sexual harassment allegations from 2017, which he was cleared of, but he sort of made these comments which seemed like he didn't completely understand the politics around that, and that has just landed so badly with what is, you know, possibly, like, not a huge group of people, really, like, you know, Corbynite feminists and other Corbynites who aren't so interested in the feminist side maybe won't be bothered. But I think he has probably damaged a large part of his appeal there. And, you know, he's up against Rebecca Long Bailey anyway, and, like, competing for quite similar voters.
Yeah, a big problem for Clive Lewis in that almost the fact he's probably almost certainly not going to make the ballot almost proves his point, which is the whole... Actually, he's made this point explicitly, which is Corbyn... The Corbyn project didn't deliver on its radical promise. And actually, you know, basically the you know, subject of his pitch is Corbyn was bad at the sort of politics Corbyn represented. And that goes for both the sort of democratising the party thing, but it also goes for the sort of low politics of fixing selections and, you know, more broadly, actually winning, putting your candidates in winnable seats. Because had Jeremy Corbyn managed to radically reshape the PLP, we'd have a campaign group of 50 MPs in this parliament and Clive Lewis would probably make the ballot, you know, or would have a much better chance of making the ballot. But instead, we've got a campaign group that's, what, about 25, 30 at the absolute, absolute maximum. And there is no viable route for Clive Lewis to make the ballot.
Yeah, and I think where that interview does become really problematic for him in this stage of the race is that the only viable route to the ballot for him would have been one in which he emerged as the candidate of, we've got to have a, you know, it's time to have a black leader. You know, Diane endorses him, she also endorses Dawn Butler, you know, then, you know, David Lammy endorses him. You can see how the path to that opens. But of course, for you to be able to play that card, you have to have credibility on a number of diversity issues. You can't just have credibility on your own. But yeah, I think you're right, Patrick, say it does kind of also slightly expose that his critique of actually existing Corbynism
is correct.
So actually, you know, I was going to say, let's skip ahead to Becky Long-Bailey, but let's do so. Actually, one of the things I must say I do really like about all of the candidates in this race is if we had described one group of them as second tier in 2015, oh, the incessant whining we'd have had.
Whereas, and not a peep from any of them.
They do all broadly accept, and yeah, of course, there are two candidates who are definitely going to make the ballot, and then there are some who, let's say, have a more tricky...
Yeah. Corbyn would have been happy to be on A tier at all.
Yeah. I mean, so Emily Thornberry is kind of like the political... She's a victim of the political of climate change, right? Like, her political success was, like, the viable route for the Corbynites to get someone who wouldn't purge them all onto the ballot, and to being and the viable route for Corbyn skeptics to get someone who, you know, wouldn't deselect them all from the ballot. But because for different reasons it doesn't feel to either of those groups that they need Emily Thornberry, she's down to her core vote, which, I mean, I wouldn't have expected to be Fabian Hamilton, but...
Shadow foreign ministers looking out for each other.
Yeah, and I think the fascinating thing is, I don't know what you think, Alva, having gone through all of her pitches, but I think her qualities as a political operator, you can see that in the quality of the pitch, the quality of the, you know, the kind of way that they all, in different ways, on election night, did their kind of, like, this is a concession speech, but also kind of a launch speech if you squint. You know, I thought she delivered that very well. But ultimately, it doesn't matter how effective you are at being a T-Rex. When the meteor hits, it's hard to come back from that.
I mean, I was really looking forward to discussing this on the podcast because I'm still kind of baffled by how badly she's doing. And I just sort of can't really work out why individual MPs might not think of nominating her, even though, you know, I've heard your arguments around, you know, her being the victim of sort of basically like changes within the party structure. Because, you know, coming back to Anoush's point about like what a leader looks like, I think that, you know, she is like very credibly what people should think of when they think of a leader who could, you know, someone who could lead you to an emphatic victory, because she's sort of, you know, feisty, and she's very good at pulling on emotional levers when she speaks. You know, she has an impressive backstory. She's very articulate. And yeah, I think that, you know, she really could be that person. Yeah. And it's amazing to me that no one thinks that, apparently.
No, I agree. Like she swears, she sounds like she's straight talking. She's also someone who's managed to tread the Corbyn skeptic, Corbynite tightrope like Keir Starmer has managed to do in the Shadow Cabinet. In fact, she is kind of like a Keir Starmer, but with the Ed Miliband baggage, and also the fact that she's a woman and maybe she just doesn't look as much like a leader as he does. But I do think her performances at the dispatch box when she's filled in for PMQs have been really good. So I do think that you have to put it down to the baggage that she has from the Miliband era and just not being as sort of impressive to a certain audience as Keir Starmer has been while filling that same space, you know, pushing for a second referendum, being in the shadow cabinet and loyal, but not in the Corbynite circles.
Yeah, and maybe it's silly to overestimate the importance of like being able to do a politician-y sound bite. But the thing I've been struck by with other second tier candidates is when they're asked on something like Iran, and they have to sort of for a second, you know, audition to actually be the leader and just sort of say their take on it in a statesmanly way. You know, I think a lot of them struggle. Like Lisa Nandy was all right. Jess Phillips didn't do very well. And you can sort of see that they get slightly nervous doing it. I mean, maybe that's not very important. It's a sort of very like someone who isn't very interested in politics take on what a politician does. But Emily Thornberry does that sort of stuff very well. You know, she's been doing it on Newsnight for years, and the less experienced ones don't have that. You know, she has that leadership box ticked and just isn't appealing to anyone. And yeah, and I agree that all her pitches do show that she, you know, has thought seriously about the problems within the party and, you know, has come up with her solutions. And yeah,
I think because she does have this problem that she's a second, I think the root of this is she was a first tier candidate for a long time, and then because of change in the PLP, the scale of the defeat, she's become a second tier candidate. But yeah, I think those qualities, yeah, from a kind of scientific interest perspective, I'm very disappointed she's not going to make the ballot, because I'm intrigued to see, because obviously I think the membership is in the same place as the PLP on her. Would the fact that she is the most effective politician of the group allow her over the course of the 4 months to turn the ship around, potentially? I mean, I think it would be a stress test of you know, how much you can, you know, through having the sort of the right instincts in terms of how to position yourself politically, affect the turnaround. The other sort of candidate in the second tier, of course, is Lisa Nandy, who in many ways is actually like your classic, like, second tier candidate, in that she's basically got a body of ideas, and if she gets onto the ballot, it will basically be because the body of ideas has allowed her to leapfrog the lack of any meaningful institutional support.
I think that what you wrote, Stephen, about no one commissioning who is Lisa Nandy profiles in a hurry is the exact problem for Lisa Nandy, because she's someone that the public doesn't know. She's a backbench MP. You know, most people haven't heard of her, but lots of hacks know her really well, you know, because she's been around a while. She's good with journalists. She's a good political operator. And also Wigan is quite a popular place for journalists to go and visit because of the Road to Wigan Pier, George Orwell's book.
George Formby.
Yeah.
Uncle Joe's mint balls.
Yeah. So, you know, lots of people do know her in the sort of Westminster bubble. Most people don't know her outside, but no one's making that bridge. And like you say about her campaign, I don't think she's not building that bridge particularly effectively so far. But because she's got these strong ideas and she performed well at the hustings, that's the thing that will carry her through. But is that what, you know, is that enough?
I think another problem for Lisa Nandy, if she reaches the ballot, I mean, it can go one of two ways. The first way is that I got a text this morning from an MP who is, I wouldn't call him a Nandyite, but he's on the soft left, and, you know, is a Nandy fan broadly. And he said, do people, by which he means, like, you know, normal human beings, think Lisa is on the left of the party? And it's a really interesting question, because if you just go purely on the basis of a piece written by a lobby journalist the other day in which Lisa Nandy was repeatedly referred to as a centrist, which is...
It's not where I put her in my internal map
which
of the Labour Party.
But nonetheless, the fact the question is being asked and the answer is being got wrong in Westminster, I think speaks to a potential pitfall, which is if you speak to a sort of lay member of the Labour Party, you know, OK, they're not reading the non-existent Lisa Nandy profiles, which speak in detail about her, you know, strain of definitely towards the left of the Labour Party politics. Instead, they go, Lisa Nandy, I know she's from Wigan and she's good on towns, but also didn't she co-chair Owen Smith's campaign, resign from the shadow cabinet in 2016? You know what I mean? That is the problem. You know, there is nothing apart from town memes, which are absolutely banging, and very good critiques of, you know, Labour's, you know, crumbling coalition. There is nothing filling the vacuum, as it were, to replace those gobbets of information.
Yeah, I think obviously, I think as I wrote in my free morning email, I think there's this weird death zone for candidates when they become old news for political insiders, for political journalists.
Clive is another one, right?
Yeah, right. But actually, yeah, like the average Labour member, and I think lots of people do have this idea that the average Labour member is as politically engaged and well-informed as the average New Statesman podcast listener. I'm not saying that purely to butter up our listeners, but I do think that's one of the major sort of analytical problems a lot of the lobby has when they analyse, like, who the... I'm going to steal Patrick's anecdote, despite the fact he's right in front of me. During the 2015, one of the 2015 hustings, when they, after they'd nominated the leader, they moved on to the deputy leader, and one member turned to another and said, "Who is Stella Creasy?" And like, when you enter this zone when everyone in the lobby believes you to be not worth a "who is so-and-so" profile, I just think it's going to be difficult for her to get CLP nominations from the standing start of people not really knowing who she is. And then there is this thing, right, where, like, basically... So her two central big ideas are radical devolution within... I was going to say radical devolution within, and I realised, well, actually, it's actually radical devolution within England, because she can't press a button marked to devolution within Wales. That's not her call. Mm. And then listening to the voters Labour has lost. And again, to come back to the unfinished revolution, policy, as the great Toblerone says, policy positions matter, right? The way you show that you've listened to voters is you respond. And seeing as the things that broadly those voters don't like are statist things like, you know, the smacking ban, already law by the SNP government in Scotland, being enacted by the Welsh Labour government in Wales, I mean, not quite as we speak, but, you know, as we speak. And, of course, the other thing they do kvetch about whenever you're kind of doing is immigration and all women shortlists. Now, those are all things which are very dear to not only the parts of Labour's coalition in the country that they got last time, but are quite important to the membership. For me, the question is that town's agenda a coherent policy programme that can win voters back and get consent from Labour members? Because I think that the area of the landing zone for both of those is quite small, right?
And that's the problem MPs have, right? They say Nandyism. I think you'll be hard-pressed to find, okay, there is a section of MPs who disagree with it. People say Nandyism is a brilliant structural critique of what's happened to the Labour Party, but how do you translate it into a programme for opposition? And, you know, actually, you know what it would mean in government, but how does that translate to opposition and winning an election?
Yeah. The fascinating thing I think about Nandyism, and I want to know, Alva, obviously you'll have a particular view on this, having had to go through her back catalogue, is it feels to me that Nandyism is the explicit message that Becky Long-Bailey kind of visibly believes is what they need to add to Corbyn, right? The kind of, when you take progressive patriotism, I'm sorry, I'm trying to delete it. When you add that to, yes, I would pull the trigger on the nuclear button, you basically visibly have someone who thinks the problem with Corbyn isn't the stuff about bank holidays on saints' days was not sufficiently believed because of Corbyn's baggage and back catalogue and views on foreign and security policy, right? That's the quiet part than Becky Long-Bailey doesn't think she can say out loud and keep her coalition together. I mean, am I crazy here?
Yeah, or I mean, it feels like Lisa Nandy's pitch is the comprehensive, fully considered response to the problem we keep talking about of Remainers being so disconnected from Leave voters and the electoral coalition within Labour completely collapsing. And Nandyism is a really coherent response to it, where it's basically like, you know, this used to be a coalition, you know, between, you know, it was a coalition with a base of working people, and then middle class people hopped on and supported it, and it's switched, and now it's like it's mainly a base of more affluent city dwelling middle class people, and we've lost the working classes or people in Labour heartlands, and we need to get them back. And it's as though her solution is basically to then start listening to working class voters and people in heartlands again. And I think she makes it quite cogently, and then the case that Rebecca Long-Bailey makes is less clear on that. I mean, I thought, like, the reading through all of her stuff. I think actually the most memorable thing was just stuff that she said on Sophie Ridge, when she said, you know, people in Walthamstow, you know, rich middle class people, like Labour voters, you know, they genuinely want equality and they want to be winning in Wigan. And I thought that, like, that was kind of an interesting approach, where she's basically sort of pitching to leafy Remainers to back her and be convinced by her argument that she gets the problem. Whereas Rebecca Long Bailey's, because she's, you know, trying to, she's kind of constrained by her loyalty, basically, it's just much less clear.
You know, Paul Mason, intermittently of this parish, who's written a very interesting piece today in which he talks about Keir Starmer and Clive Lewis being the answer for people on the left, has a line which means, in which he says something like, you know, if winning back, and this is actually the big question for the Labour Party in the next 5 years and longer, and some MPs are grappling with it in private, it's if winning back our heartlands, TM, means chasing people down a rabbit hole of prejudices, I don't want to go there. And instead, you know, Labour has to assemble a new coalition. And I think the danger of Lisa Nandy's town pitch, or the way, you know, people read it, I think there's a danger of, you know, it's possible to mistake politicians that Blue Labour people like for actual people who endorse the sort of coarser end of those Blue Labour ideas. You know, it's not as, I don't think it's necessarily fair to say, you know, obviously in your free morning email this morning, Stephen, you wrote about Lisa Nandy's line about how dare we tell working class people what's good for them. And obviously, you know, there's one reading of that, which is the social issues one, and the, you know, yes, we are going to ban menthol fags and it's going to be a good thing. There's, you can read it like that, and you can also say, you know, is it a faith and flag? You know, how dare you say to working class people you're not allowed to be prejudiced? Whereas I would have read that more like, you know, is it sort of like a structural critique of power or whatever, or is it a critique, is it a cultural critique? And I think the problem, the danger for Nandy is that people, especially in the Labour Party, the membership in the electorate, read it as the, yeah, but, you know, it's fine for people to be, you know, un-PC, when actually I don't think that's the space Nandy is in at all.
No.
Or what do you think?
Well, I guess the thing is, I don't think that is the space that she is in. I guess this is where I am more sympathetic. I want to qualify that. But it's where I'm more sympathetic to the end of Blue Labour than people don't like. I don't agree with it, but I think it is a meaningful political destination. My concern is that I think a lot of, yeah, a lot of Nandyism and a lot of people around it seem to mistake telling voters in cities that they don't get it with reaching out to people in towns. And they're not the same thing. Like, fundamentally, yes, opposition parties tend to, like, over-index on policy because policy announcement is the one thing you can do. But actually, because it's the one thing you can do, the way you show you've listened is through policy announcements which matter to the people you're listening to. Now, it may well be true that if you have, yeah, in the towns that Labour either lost or did particularly badly, yeah, kind of only narrowly held, if you, you know, then if you, you know, give people in Hemsworth, you know, proper devolution, then, you know, they do suddenly go, oh, actually, maybe, like, the four freedoms are a price that are worth paying being in the single market. However, in order to hold, to win power, you can't just go, look, actually, I've listened to you, and the thing you think you care about is actually, you know, like when someone says the problem here is that I don't, then, you know, the problem here is a Polish shop. Actually, it's not listening to that person to say your real concern is about wages and a lack of meaningful devolution. Like, that may actually be the root cause, but the person you're trying to convince doesn't believe that. And I just think then either you do the kind of actual proper Blue Labour thing of you go, no, I am going to, like, move towards these people on cultural issues. I then think where Blue Labour falls down, as well as the fact that I don't think it's desirable, is that they refuse to realise that meeting the voters on immigration does mean that you have to be less ambitious on spending. I'm sorry, right? Yeah, like yeah, the yes, we don't all experience GDP in the aggregate. However, we do ultimately experience the amount of money that goes into the care system in the aggregate. And if you want to meet the public's ambition for control over migration, and you want to meet the, well, in the case of Labour, not meet, because Labour and the public are aligned in their level of lack of openness to you know, kind of all singing, all dancing trade deals. But if you want to continue to be where the public are on trade, if you want to meet the public on immigration, well then, sorry, I'm afraid then that means that you probably can't have the ambitious childcare policy you wanted to have. You probably can't have, you know, like the thing is, ultimately, if we're going to have a situation in which we sign up to a Brexit end state than people in small towns like, I'm afraid London can't redistribute money to improve Wigan. Because they're not going to have very much of it. Yeah, it's yeah. Yeah, like that's a political choice too. And I just think that ultimately Blue Labour, the kind of end of Blue Labour that most of the Labour membership doesn't like, has seen that nettle and has decided to grasp it. My concern is that actually Nandyism, if to be successful among the members, it doesn't grasp that nettle, and then it just ends up alienating everyone by not doing it properly if it wins.
It's interesting, when people also talk about devolution as a policy end in itself, obviously, the most recent tranche of devolution, i.e. in the city regions, with the exception of the Tees Valley in the west of England, has brought about Labour mayors because they are in city regions that vote reliably for the Labour Party. But actually, if you're talking about devolving power meaningfully to smaller unitary authorities and towns, if you look at the tranche of regional devolution before that, directly elected mayors, etc., what happened in Doncaster, in Hartlepool and Mansfield the first time, people elected local populists because they were the people who were willing to go out and say, this is crap. Father Philip Davis in Doncaster, the only person with the English Democrats, banned the Pride March, or, you know, he might not have done that exactly, but it was in that ballpark. Hangus the Monkey in Hartlepool, a.k.a. Stuart Drummond, who actually turned out to be a very good mayor despite being a man in a monkey costume. Kate Allsop in Mansfield, you know, playing all their houses independence. And, you know, if you look at Scotland, right, it didn't kill nationalism stone dead, as George Robertson said. It's looking like Tamdiel's motorway to independence with no exits, right? So actually, there is the price of, you know, Nandyism in practice, or, you know, regional devolution, might be that actually it catalyses at a local level the detachment from the Labour Party.
Yeah, I mean, also, I think the thing is that people do seem to have forgotten that growing pash for devolution and indifference to it in the country was not absent from Labour's, you know, like, if so, like, the, because basically, right, in some ways, one of the interesting arguments in this election is, when did it start to go wrong for the Labour Party? And broadly, Nandyism is the one which goes sometime in the mid-noughties, right? But actually, like, that Labour government loved being like, hey guys, what you really want is some devolution. And a large chunk of the country repeatedly said no. Now, you know, I don't know this for certain because there is sadly not very much polling about it. However, to be honest, I feel like the average council, if you knocked on doors and went, do you think your council should be given more power, they would go, they'd definitely say yes to money. But I think if you said, do you think they should be given more power, they'd go, no, they can't run the X now.
Yeah, people don't like politicians. This is the fundamental thing. Mm. That was the Dominic Cummings case against the Regional Assembly in the North East in 2004, which is, do you want to pay the salaries of 50 more Assembly members? The answer is no. Look at Liverpool, which, you know, despite being a Labour city, if you ask, you go into a pub in Liverpool city centre and say, what do you think about local politics here? Chances are someone will say to you, we've got three mayors. Isn't that ridiculous? Like, you know, like, people, another layer of local government isn't necessarily something people will go, sign me up. It's likelier that, you know, it becomes another lightning rod for amorphous anti-politics feeling, I would say. But there is also the question of, does devolution necessarily mean electoral devolution? Are you doing what John McDonnell did about regional investment, etc., etc.? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, what you want is invisible devolution, really, don't you? Where people feel empowered, but they don't really know why, basically, because...
Yeah. And maybe that is literally that you can go down your high street and, you know, most of the shops are open, and exactly, you can, your Marks and Spencers is there. And
but again, and this is why I kind of keep coming back to, at some point, this agenda does have to engage with, wow, Labour goes down to a defeat and Stephen the Hawk comes right back out. But yeah, it does have to engage with, like, the reality of how you pay for this stuff, yeah, right? Yeah. Like, you know, action to defend the high street does involve, whether it's what I would see as my preferred solution, which is whether it's like the necessary level of ambition in public transport. Like, the reason when you, what the places which have flourishing restaurants, cafes, all have in common is that people don't have to worry about getting drunk over their meal, because there's, you know, whether it's Edinburgh's brilliant buses or London's astonishing public transport or Manchester's tram, like, what they all have in common is a thing that you can, like, stumble into that gets you home.
Or they have people who don't care about getting drunk and stumbling home, i.e. students and young people.
Yeah, exactly. And if you don't have that, you do not have a high street in the age of e-commerce. Now, again, so you can fix that in a number of ways, but all of them involve quite a lot of money. And if, and again, if you've decided that you want to change our economic model in a way that, you know, does not have ambitious trade deals, does not have a high standard of access to the European market, well, okay, how do those numbers kind of cohere? But anyway, I think that's all of the second tier candidates, so we'll discuss the first tier candidates in part two.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, we discussed four, five. How many candidates?
We covered Chess Phillips.
We discussed the second tier candidates who, all for different reasons, have an uncertain path onto the ballot. Mostly guaranteed. Well, I think Emily and Clive Lewis unlikely to get on the ballot via the MP's route.
Lisa Nandy is closer to it than she is further from, you know what I mean? She's sort of...
I think Lisa Nandy and Jess Phillips will both get on fine by the MP's route. But of course, you have to either get the support of members, which is where, for some, being in that zone of well-known by people like us, not that well-known by Labour members, becomes difficult. And for some, you need the support of trade unions. And I think, you know, Keir has, you know, from a technical perspective, I think has fought the best campaign thus far. But he's also been given this huge boost today with the support of Unison for two reasons. One, of course, that makes it easier for him to get on the ballot. He's basically all but on now. But also, Unison backing him makes it much more difficult to see how anyone not called Becky Long-Bailey gets on via the trade union route, which does mean, I think, probably the two candidates we're about to talk about are going to be the ones on it. But yeah, so Becky Long-Bailey...
I think Becky Long-Bailey has some really good qualities that were very useful for the Corbyn project while she's still in the shadow cabinet, which were that she was a really reliable interview. I think when they put her on programmes when Labour was having, you know, yet another crisis and she had to defend the indefensible, she was pretty good at that. I think she's quite unflappable. And that kind of training in the sort of media circuit, as well as boosting her profile, has also given her the sort of steeliness for those kind of interviews that she's grappling with now as one of the front runners to be Labour leader. Mm-hmm. That said, she's answered a few questions in interviews that I'm sure you've been looking into in more detail, Alva, in some strange ways, like giving Jeremy Corbyn 10 out of 10. I know that was supposed to be a sort of signal to the members that she wants to win over to win, but it still seemed rather odd. I think that would be jarring even to Corbyn fans, wouldn't it?
What I think is interesting is you're exactly right about her being, you know, someone who would do the kind of what I always think of, the like, you know, but the Prime Minister has eaten a baby while abusing the mother. It's like, yes, but actually, if you look at how many babies the last government used to eat while insulting their mothers, it's down year on year. Is that whenever I speak to Labour activists about people like James Cleverly, or Rishi Sunak, right? Like, Rishi Sunak and James Cleverly have been willing to look pretty stupid defending baby eating. and they've done it very well. But I feel I talk to conservative activists, and maybe this is like an availability bias in the type of conservative activists who read The New Statesman and therefore like go up to talk to me are perhaps like more, you know, they're more open-minded. Mm. They'll go, I think it's really good. But I do think in general, conservative activists are more likely to reward you for turning up and like eating a bucket of crap because the leader has accidentally left a bucket of crap lying everywhere. Whereas, you know, Lucy Powell and Caroline, I remember once someone said to me during the 2015 deputy leadership election, they said, well, I like Caroline Flint, but whenever she's on television, Labour seem to be having a hard time. And I just was like, I don't understand how you've precisely, and it's, you know, whether it's Caroline Flynn or Lucy Powell or, you know, when people are like, oh, it's Becky Wrong Daly, it's just like, okay, explain to me how you would have got out of that interview, that, you know, because she was the, like, the walls have melted and it's all falling down. I think that is linked to her two biggest problems. The first is that I think among some members who voted for Corbyn, she is just associated with failure because of the whenever I see you on television, things are going badly wrong kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like the Wrong Daily thing, the Rebecca Wrong Daily name by which she's known, is less, as Anoush was saying, a reflection on her competence because, you know, she went out to bat and did so manfully and unflappably the whole time. It's just because she was, you know, entrusted and dutifully did trot out at times nonsensical lines to take or lines which the Labour, the bulk of the PLP, absolutely hated. If you are, outrider is the wrong term because you can't outride from within the project, but, you know, if you are a reliable spokesman for a project that lots of people in the Parliamentary Labour Party don't like, then of course that's going to, and indeed the whole political media complex, you know, don't like, of course that's going to have, it's going to be your reputation is, you know, she's not very good because she represents something and is a servant of a project we don't think is, you know, legitimate or...
Yeah.
I think there's also maybe a problem with her where people think more of the idea of Rebecca Long Bailey than the reality of her, where I was kind of struck by this, you know, when she was on the Today programme, I think that Martha Carney was sort of reckoning with how amiable she was, and I think that there's maybe an idea, possibly, you know, from people who aren't going to be voting in this election anyway, but there's this sort of idea of Rebecca Long Bailey as some sort of puppet, someone who isn't her own woman, someone who's sort of like being masterminded and controlled by all these other shady characters from the Corbyn Project. And it's reinforced by this idea that we don't really know who she is, that she joined the Labour Party quite late, and that, you know, she's a John McDonnell protégé. But then you get the reality of Rebecca Long Bailey, which is far more convincing. Like, she's much more personable. You know, she likes eating Chinese and watching Netflix. She has a lot of warmth. She gave a really good speech at Labour conference. And I think, like, the more... I mean, even though she has done some poor interviews like the ITV one, I think the more people interact with the reality of Rebecca Long Bailey, the better she does. But there's this sort of the problem, the idea of Rebecca Long Bailey is quite similar to the idea of Corbyn as this sort of like far left threat, and it's all kind of shady, and I think that's kind of part of the problem, and it like it denies her a personality and an individuality, which is like absolutely not what a leader should have.
Exactly. And you saw that in the Not Leadership campaign video that she brought out during the election of her youth in Manchester. That was a sort of turning point where people suddenly realised, like, oh, she actually has her own story. She's not just this person who's been groomed by John McDonnell to take the reins.
But equally, she is also someone who has sat on the NEC as an extension of Jeremy Corbyn's will for the best part of 3 years. And that's why I think, so obviously, the first problem is that, yeah, I think the first problem that a candidacy struggles is if you're someone who thinks that you need to in some way signal to the country that you've got it. If you're a Labour member who prioritises that symbolic thing, will be, well, it's she is not that. But also, like, and I know I said in the first part, look, I think actually if you look at what she kind of said about the progressive patriotism stuff, if you look at the kind of course I would press the button, right, that is someone who clearly does think that the way you win is you keep the economics and junk the culture and foreign policy stuff, right? However, it's one, I think it's hard to do that if you literally feel you cannot get away with using the words progressive patriotism a second time. I think your failure state is you say those things just enough times than like a little bit of the, like, you know, then, you know, 200 people in Putney or however many it would be to flip that seat back to the Conservatives go, oh yeah, maybe this isn't for me, but you don't actually win any more votes back in Wakefield or and of course if 200 people go missing to the Lib Dems in Putney, that has implications for your ability to hold Hemsworth or Pontefract, even if you don't lose any more votes on the other end of your coalition. But also she can't get into that space because she has consciously chosen not to. A surprisingly large number of journalists keep going, I don't understand why Angela Rayner isn't running for leader and she's running for chairman. She's like, well, that's because Becky has prioritised being the candidate of the party's power brokers over being the candidate who can get 70, 75%, whatever biblical landslide that Angela Rayner is inevitably heading towards in the deputy leadership race. She has prioritised being the candidate over being able to maximise her chances of winning, and also clearly is still prioritising, you know, the kind of the support of power brokers over saying the things that she does. Yeah. I also think, right, like, ultimately, she needs there to be a left-right dividing line in this election. It's tactically inept to pick the Green New Deal. And I think it's not only tactically inept, it reveals a kind of delusion about actually existing Corbynism. Now, the Green New Deal as it existed as an original motion was a radical idea and upset bits of the Labour movement. But the trade unions have done an awfully good job of sanding all of those edges off, right? So if your USP is, I wrote this policy, right? Well, that means you're sticking with that policy. There's nothing in the Green New Deal. As the fact that Jess Phillips, Keir Starmer, Lisa Nandy, obviously Clive Lewis, but yeah, like all of the candidates have gone, of course, I'm for that. If you don't have the, and this, I come back to my point I made in part one, right? If you don't have the wit to maximise your chances over four months, you don't have the wit to do it over 5 years. I thought it was a striking misread of where the other candidates would go to make Green New Deal your USP, not welfare spending.
And also she was prevaricating on what her immigration policy would be as well in that Today programme interview that you mentioned, which is, you know, like you say, if that's something that she doesn't feel like she can say as someone who's supposed to be the sort of continuity candidate, although she's trying to shed that reputation now, then how is she going to say it while she's running an opposition party for probably 10 years?
And I also sort of wonder, I mean, how far could she stray from the perfect loyal Corbynite brief while still being the continuity candidate? Like, I mean, maybe, I don't know if you agree, but I mean, it's maybe just a huge failure of strategy if you're already seen as someone who's very close to Corbyn and McDonnell to not decide that you can be a little bit freer. Like, it won't matter. Like, Corbyn probably won't be that hurt if you say you give him a 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
For his leadership. You know, that maybe she could afford to be a bit more flexible on those things while still knowing that to the membership and to the people that matter, she will still be the closest thing to Corbyn that they're getting in the election.
I think the big question is how much the membership care about having a pure Corbynite candidate. I feel like that's something that we can't know, but a lot of commentators take for granted.
A pro-Corbyn membership, which this membership provably is, right? Every opportunity they've voted for Jeremy Corbyn, or in the case of, to pluck an example out of thin air, the NEC elections, Jeremy Corbyn's candidates, which the John Lansman slate very literally was. It was the JC9. It wasn't the left slate, although the left slate may well have won by association anyway. It was pitched as we exist to enact Jeremy Corbyn's will. Is that the same as a Corbynite membership? Is everybody who voted in 2015 and 2016 for Jeremy Corbyn a Corbynite? Well, given that Corbyn won a majority of members, or certainly a plurality of members who had been in the Labour Party pre 2010, wasn't it, in 2015, like, no, obviously, like, these people aren't all Corbynites by ideological conviction. Corbyn just, you know, said something and represented something that they wanted. It doesn't necessarily mean that they will naturally pick, you know, the anointed one.
Yeah, and I think also in terms of the stuff we've said repeatedly about the fact that, you know, people just huge, well, I think there's this thing, and I think a bunch of people in journalism, having failed to cover the Labour Party and why it was electing Corbyn very well, their sort of big theory for what happened was, oh, well, Labour members are stupid, they do stupid things. This is actually a narrative that some Labour members themselves have come to share. You know, like all of that kind of like, you know, like, yeah, like, oh, they're a cult. And that's why I'm backing someone who's never been on a front, never spoken from the dispatch box to take on the might of Boris Johnson and win. But actually, if you remember the, you know, all of the various doubts and criticisms we've had of him, you know, in 2015 and throughout the project, you know, culminating, of course, in our decision not to endorse, were not things that were known or of high salience to the average person who voted for him when he did fight far and away the best campaign. You know, he just had better energy, better videos, better slogans, had a plan to get 50% of the vote plus one, which was not something you could say for some of the people who ran in 2015. And that, to me, is actually the main reason why I do think, thus far, it is Keir Starmer who looks the most likely to win, because he is fighting an incredibly ruthless campaign.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that is the question. Is he fighting a ruthless campaign, or is Keir Starmer a bloke from the middle of the Labour Party fighting a campaign that speaks to people from the middle of the Labour Party?
And as you've said, actually, if Long Bailey does win with the imprimatur of Unite and Momentum, that won't be because Labour Party members necessarily look, well, if Lemma Kluskey and John Landsman say she's all right, I suppose I'll have to vote for her as well because she's the most left-wing candidate. As you said, more likely that's because they will see a load of Momentum viral videos about Rebecca Long Bailey. They will be rung by a Unite phone bank, or if they're a Unite affiliate, they will get a jazzy leaflet about Rebecca Long Bailey in the Post. It will be sort of, it will be incidental rather than ideological, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's quite a good point about thinking about the reasons that people voted for Corbyn in 2015. And thinking about that, I actually was thinking that Lisa Nandy, that's why Lisa Nandy's doing so well, because I think in part it was that preparedness. Well, I think you can disagree with this. I think it was partly a preparedness in the Labour membership and the people who joined Labour out of sort of political conviction to vote against your own interests in favour of the common good. And I think Lisa Nandy is really trying to tap into that by basically appealing to people who in lots of cases aren't from towns, who are like much more middle class than the people that they're talking about. And she's sort of telling them to get on side with her idea to fight for those people's interests. I think that there's something like kind of emotional about that pitch, which is really working, and it's so anecdotal, but I'm surprised that people I know who like work for trade unions or are like union people are very impressed by Lisa Nandy, and having said the whole time that they would love, you know, Rebecca Long Bailey or Angela Rayner to stand, are starting to say that they like Lisa Nandy.
Mm-hmm. John, for me, Lisa Nandy is in the crudder zone, right, which is where, you know, I think lots of people would have said, indeed, when he ran for deputy in 2007 and in 2010, you know, there was a John Crudder-shaped hole in both contests. But is it the role of a Lisa Nandy-style candidate necessarily to win? You know, obviously she's in this race to win it, but, like, is the function of candidates like John Crudder and Lisa Nandy to oxygenate debates rather than, I suppose, Brian Gould was serious about winning in 92, but, like, actually, like, was his function just to wave a flag, if you know what I mean, and, you know, talk about ideas, given that, yeah, that's probably a shallow reading of 92, but you know what I mean, like, if you're not going to win.
I mean, so the thing I do kind of struggle with, right, in terms of grading, I didn't realise we've drifted back to the second tier, is it feels pretty easy to assess Becky Long Bailey and Keir Starmer, right, because they are obviously and palpably candidates for the top job. And it feels quite easy to assess Emily Thornberry because she was a campaign for the top job who has been hit by climate change. Whereas you then have a bunch of people who are just like, are you really just running for the shadow cabinet? Much easier in deputy leader, which we'll, of course, discuss at a later date. But, I mean, like, Rosanna Allen Khan is basically running for the, hey, guys, Joe, wouldn't I be a great shadow health secretary? that's quite literally her campaign, right? I mean, like, she's got the word doctor in her logo. I have so much time for it. Like, it's like, it's just so wonderfully like this kind of like, hey, Rosanna, she could be shadow health secretary. It's wonderful. Is it a campaign I guess I just think where I think it falls down is that in 2015, Corbyn was very willing to say what he thought. And in different ways, the three candidates who, it feels to me, have a plausible path to 51% of the vote. The interesting question for all of them is, do they actually believe what they're saying? And will that gap be exposed over the course of this leadership election? Because in different ways, I do think they've all got a timer attached to them. With Keir, right, in many ways, so there are so many MPs like Keir, people who've had an incredibly successful career outside of politics, who they come into politics and the thing that we know what they're about on is their previous tenure. So I think we have a pretty good idea that Keir is, to put it mildly, quite tough on crime and also quite radical on corporate overreach, standing up to powerful libel, etc., etc., right? We've got a really clear idea who Keir is on that kind of stuff. On the other stuff, it's like, well, what are his other politics? Is this campaign, you know, a reflection of his raw id? Is it an incredibly effective approach to win power within the Labour Party? With Becky, I think at least, then yeah, she has decided that she thinks that you can win with the economics if you can just move a little bit on the culture, diffuse the kind of Brexit-related issues. However, she's clearly already kind of slightly gone, oh, didn't like that backlash about the progressive patriotism line. I'm going to kind of slightly say it by other means. Will that unravel during the leadership election? Yeah, with Nandi, is she... Yeah, like, yeah, with this kind of issue of, you know, is she the candidate of, yeah, like, you actually win towns over by listening to what they've actually said? Is she the candidate of going, it's all very difficult, I spent however many weeks talking about Brexit and then didn't vote for any end state? Because if she's that, right, I think that comes unravelled over the course of, yeah, of the four months. Then, yeah, you just have Jess Phillips, who, to be honest, I just don't think can win. So I don't think she so much has a timer, as in her timer has already reached zero.
Yeah, I thought when that YouGov poll dropped and it said 11% Jess Phillips, I was like, wow, that's a higher floor than I expected. But increasingly, I sort of think that's a ceiling, the more I see of Jess Phillips, the leadership candidate.
I just basically think, right, there are four candidates who Labour members know. Keir, Emily, Jess, Becky. And therefore, I'm not saying none of those candidates' numbers can change, but I just think for different reasons they can feel more happy or more worried about their numbers. And then, like, yeah, people, yeah, it's like, yeah, people don't know what Lisa Nandy's political position is. Yeah, the average, yeah, you know, members of the lobby don't know her position, let alone the average Labour member.
Sorry to interrupt, but I wonder if perhaps there's a danger of overthinking it. And actually, what we know about the Labour membership is that they do vote for men. And with Angela Rayner's place as a sort of shoo-in for deputy leader, perhaps that allows people to think, well, we have a northern woman who's going to be elected, so I'm happy to vote for this London MP man whose politics I don't actually know that much about, but he seems quite, you know, impressive. You know, is it sort of obvious that that's what's going to happen? And
yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good point, right? Does the fact that Ange is considered, I think rightly, to be a shoo-in for that job, does it mean that essentially people make their... I understand why it is that the kind of, like, the Corbynite elite is nominating Long Bailey and Bergen, but I think that is, and it's obviously not within Long Bailey's control. She will nominate Rayner and has said she will vote for her. I think there's one question. One, as you say, do people go like, well, we've already got one. Two women?
Yeah.
Yeah, like.
Or I actually do think it probably was a thought process of some people, like watching the Keir Starmer launch video, which was really good and quite convincing. People were thinking, oh, yeah, I probably will vote for him then. Oh, and then it'll probably be Angela Rayner. That'll be a nice team. And then as you say, it sort of allays the fears around electing the white man who's barrister, because it seems well balanced with Angela Rayner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So weirdly, Rayner could be Becky Long Bailey's worst enemy. In
yeah.
But also the fact that you have Diane and John McDonnell and... implicitly, although Corbyn has interestingly said he will not formally nominate or endorse anyone in this race. But the fact that you have kind of the big names nominating RLB and Bergen, in terms of that swing vote middle bit of the Labour Party, does that actually drag you, if you're Becky Long Bailey, into a place you don't want to be in terms of your ability to get 50% of the membership plus one? I think there's an argument to be made that it might.
Yeah, it's clear that if people keep saying Long Bailey Rayner is a joint ticket, I will, you know, put my fist through my computer monitor, because it isn't a joint ticket in any meaningful sense of the word. Like, the real joint ticket, if you look at the nominations overlap, is, and Rebecca Long Bailey won't, you know, this won't help her, as you say, is Long Bailey Bergen.
Yeah.
And Bergen will be speaking as if it is. The nominations reflect the fact that their base of support is the same, and Rayner is talking an entirely different language. If you compare her launch speech in Stockport and its warnings against, you know, fruity language on the economy with Long Bailey's Tribune piece that dropped 12 hours later, then that's not the same strategic gambit at all. And, you know, when you say to Angela Rayner, you know, it's like in the same way that prison sentences are her Majesty's pleasure, you know, like it's almost like a tick, right? You can say, who do you support? I support Rebecca Long Bailey. You know, it's a formal sort of cap doffing rather than an actual coordinated we are a team thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, whereas I guess I think, and this obviously might be my massive cognitive bias and the fact that has always been my analysis of Blair Brown. My assumption has always been, and actually they don't disagree on anything, it's just Angela Rayner is much more willing to say those things. And I kind of think if you look at the kind of things where Becky's kind of hinted at stuff and then kind of gone, oh, I didn't really mean it, she gets a lot closer to Raynerism. Mm. But as you say,
but the constraints of her, as you say, the constraints of where she is, where her coalition is, you know, her route to the ballot rather than Rayner's route to the ballot means that politics means she can't, right?
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, my colleagues Anusha Kelly and Patrick Maguire and Alva Ray. It's recorded by Emily Bootle and produced by Nick Hilton. Our music is still Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. We'll be back to our normal format next week, so if you have any questions for You Ask Us, let us know. Plus, we'll have lots and lots more about the state of politics in Wales.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.